Disc 5.
Whatever view Coker took of us, it was clear that Alf bore us no animosity. He appeared to regard the whole affair as a bit of sport. I found it a little too painful to class it so, but I mentally raised my hat to Alf. I'd a pretty good idea that in his position I'd be lacking the spirit to think of anything as a bit of sport. I finished the tea and accepted another cigarette from him.
"And what's the programme now?" I asked him.
"Coker's idea is to make us all up into parties and put one of you with each party. You to look after the scrounging and kind of act as the eyes of the rest, like. Your job will be to help us keep going until somebody comes along to straighten this perishing lot out."
"I see," I said. He cocked his head towards me. There weren't any flies on Alf. He had caught more in my tone than I had realized was there. "You reckon that's going to be a long time?" he said.
"I don't know. What's Coker say?"
Coker, it seemed, had not been committing himself to details. Alf had his own opinion, though.
"She asked me, I reckon there ain't nobody going to come. If there was, they'd have been here before this. Different if we was in some little town in the country, but London? Stands to reason they'd come here afore anywhere else. No, the way I see it, they ain't come yet. And that means they ain't never going to come. And that means there ain't nobody to come."
"Cor blimey, who'd have ever thought it could happen like this?" I didn't say anything. Alf wasn't the sort to be jollied with facile encouragements.
"Reckon that's the way you see it too," he said, after a bit.
"Doesn't look so good," I admitted. "But there still is a chance, you know, people from somewhere abroad." He shook his head.
"They'd have come before this. They'd have had loudspeaker cars round the streets telling us what to do before this."
"Nah, chum, we've had it. There ain't nobody nowhere to come, that's the fact of it." We were silent for a while, then.
"Oh, well, 'twern't a bad old life while it lasted," he said.
We talked a little about the kind of life it had been for him. He'd had various jobs, each of which seemed to have included some interesting undercover work. He summed it up.
"One way and another, I didn't do so bad.
What was your racket?"
I told him. He wasn't impressed.
"Triffies, huh? Nasty damn things, I reckon. Not natural, as you might say."
We left it at that. Alf went away, leaving me to my cogitations and a packet of his cigarettes. I surveyed the outlook and thought little of it. I wondered how the others would be taking it, particularly what would be Gisella's view. I got off the bed and went across to the window. The prospect was poor. An interior well with sheer white-tiled sides for four stories below me and a glass skylight at the bottom. There wasn't much to be done that way. Alf had locked the door after him, but I tried it just in case. Nothing in the room gave me inspiration. It had the look of belonging in a third-rate hotel, except that everything save the bed had been thrown out. I sat down again on the bed and pondered. I could perhaps tackle Alf successfully, even with my hands tied, providing he had no knife. But probably he had a knife, and that would be unpleasant. It would be no good a blind man threatening me with a knife. He would have to use it to disable me. Besides, there would be the difficulty of discovering what others I would have to pass before I could find my way out of the building. Moreover, I did not wish Alf any harm. It seemed wiser to wait for an opportunity. One was bound to come to a sighted man among the sightless. An hour later, Alf came back with a plate of food, a spoon, and more tea.
"Bit rough-like," he apologized. "But they said no knife or fork, so there it is."
While I was tackling it, I asked about the others. He couldn't tell me much and didn't know any names, but I found out that there had been women as well as men among those that had been brought here. After that, I was left alone for some hours, which I spent doing my best to sleep off the headache. When Alf reappeared with more food and the inevitable can of tea, he was accompanied by the man he had called Coker. He looked more tired now than when I had seen him before. Under his arm, he carried a bundle of papers. He gave me a searching look.
"You know the idea?" he asked.
"What Alf's told me," I admitted.
"All right, then."
He dropped his papers on the bed, picked up the top one and unfolded it. It was a street plan of Greater London. He pointed to an area covering part of Hampstead and Swiss Cottage, heavily outlined in blue pencil. "That's your beat," he said. "Your party works inside that area and not in anyone else's area. You can't have each lot going after the same pickings. Your job is to find the food in that area and see that your party gets it. That, and anything else they need. Got that?"
"Or what?" I said, looking at him.
"Or they'll get hungry. And if they do, it'll be just too bad for you. Some of the boys are tough, and we're not any of us doing this for fun. So what's your step?
Tomorrow morning we'll run you and your lot up there in lorries. After that it'll be your job to keep 'em going until somebody comes along to tidy things up."
"And if nobody does come?" I asked.
"Somebody's got to come," he said grimly.
"Anyway, there's your job, and mind you keep to your area." I stopped him as he was on the point of leaving.
"Have you got a Miss Playton here?" I asked.
"I don't know any of your names," he said.
"Fair-haired, about 5'6" or 7", grey-blue eyes," I persisted.
"There's a girl about that size and blonde, but I haven't looked at her eyes. Got something more important to do," he said as he left. I studied the map. I was not greatly taken with the district allotted to me. Some of it was a salubrious enough suburb indeed, but in the circumstances a location that included docks and warehouses would have had more to offer. It was doubtful whether there would be any sizable storage depots in this part. Still, can't all have a prize, as Alf would doubtless express it, and anyway I had no intention of staying there any longer than was strictly necessary. When Alf showed up again, I asked him if he would take a note to Gisella. He shook his head.
"Sorry, mate. Not allowed."
I promised him it should be harmless, but he remained firm. I couldn't altogether blame him. He had no reason to trust me and would not be able to read the note to know that it was as harmless as I claimed. Anyway, I'd neither pencil nor paper, so I gave that up. After pressing, he did consent to let her know that I was here and to find out the district to which she was being sent. He was not keen on doing that much, but he had to allow that if there were to be any straightening out of the mess, it would be a lot easier for me to find her again if I knew where to start looking. After that, I had simply my thoughts for company for a bit. The trouble was that I was not wholeheartedly set on any course. There was a damnable ability to see the points on both sides. I knew that common sense and the long-term view backed up Michael Beadley and his lot. If they had started, Gisella and I would doubtless have gone with them and worked with them, and yet I knew I would have been uneasy. I'd never be quite convinced that nothing could have been done for the sinking ship, never quite sure that I had not rationalized my own preference. If, indeed, there was no possibility of organized rescue, then their proposal to salvage what we could was the intelligent course. But unfortunately, intelligence is by no means the only thing that makes the human wheels go round. I was up against the very conditioning that the old doctor had said was so hard to break. He was dead right about the difficulty of adopting new principles. If, for instance, some kind of relief should miraculously arrive, I knew just what kind of a louse I'd feel to have cleared out, whatever the motives, and just how much I'd despise myself and the rest for not having stayed here in London to help for as long as it was possible. But if, on the other hand, help did not come, how would I have felt about having wasted my time and frittered my efforts away when stronger-minded people had started getting on with the salvage while the going was good? I knew I ought to make my mind up once and for all on the right course and stick to it. But I could not. I seesawed. Some hours later, when I fell asleep, I was still seesawing. There was no means of knowing which way Gisella had made up her mind. I'd had no personal message from her. But Alf had put his head in once during the evening. His communication had been brief.
"Westminster," he said. "Cool. Don't reckon that lot's going to find much grub in the Houses of Parliament."
I was woken by Alf coming in early the following morning. He was accompanied by a bigger, shifty-eyed man who fingered a butcher's knife with unnecessary ostentation. Alf advanced and dropped an armful of clothes on the bed. His companion shut the door and leaned against it, watching with a crafty eye and toying with the knife.
"Give us your mitts, mate,"
said Alf. I held my hands out towards him. He felt for the wires on my wrists and snipped them with a cutter.
Now just you put on that there clobber, chum, he said, stepping back.
I got myself dressed while the knife fancier followed every movement I made like a hawk. When I'd finished, Alf produced a pair of handcuffs. There's just these, he mentioned. I hesitated. The man by the door ceased to lean on it and brought his knife forward a little. For him, this was evidently the interesting moment. I decided maybe it was not the time to try anything and held my wrists out. Alf felt around and clicked on the cuffs. After that, he went and fetched me my breakfast. Nearly 2 hours later, the other man turned up again, his knife well in evidence. He waved it at the door.
Come on, he said.
It was the only remark I ever heard him make. With the consciousness of the knife producing an uncomfortable feeling in my back, we went down a number of flights of stairs and across a hall. In the street, two loaded lorries were waiting. Coco, with two companions, stood by the tailboard of one. He beckoned me over. Without saying anything, he passed a chain between my arms. At each end of it was a strap. One was fastened already round the left wrist of a burly blind man beside him. The other he attached to the right wrist of a similar tough case, so that I was between them. They weren't taking any unavoidable chances. I'd not try any funny business if I were you, Coker advised me. You do right by them, and they'll do right by you. The three of us climbed awkwardly onto the tailboard, and the two lorries drove off. We stopped somewhere near Swiss Cottage and piled out. There were perhaps 20 people in sight, prowling with apparent aimlessness along the gutters. At the sound of the engines, every one of them had turned towards us with an incredulous expression on his face, and as if they were parts of a single mechanism, they began to close hopefully towards us, calling out as they came. The drivers shouted to us to get clear. They backed, turned, and rumbled off by the way we had come. The converging people stopped. One or two of them shouted after the lorries. Most turned hopelessly and silently back to their wandering. There was one woman about 50 yards away. She broke into hysterics and began to bang her head against a wall. I felt sick. I turned towards my companions.
Well, what do you want first? I asked them.
A billet, said one. We've got to have some place to doss down.
I reckoned I'd have to find that at least for them. I couldn't just dodge out and leave them stranded right where we were. Now we'd come this far, I couldn't do less than find them a centre, a kind of headquarters, and put them on their feet. What was wanted was a place where the receiving, storing, and feeding could be done and the whole lot kept together. I counted them. There were 52, 14 of them women. The best course seemed to be to find a hotel. It would save the trouble of fitting out with beds and bedding. The place we found was a kind of glorified boarding house made up of 4 Victorian terrace houses knocked together, giving more than the accommodation we needed. There were already 6 people in the place when we got there. Heaven knows what had happened to the rest. We found the remnant huddled together and scared in one of the lounges. An old man, an elderly woman who turned out to have been the manageress, a middle-aged man, and 3 girls. The manageress had the spirit to pull herself together and hand out some quite high-sounding threats, but the ice, even of her most severe boarding-house manner, was thin. The old man tried to back her up by blustering a bit. The rest did nothing but keep their faces turned nervously towards us. I explained that we were moving in. If they did not like it, they could go. If, on the other hand, they preferred to stay and share equally what there was, they were free to do so. They were not pleased. The way they reacted suggested that somewhere in the place they had a cache of stores that they were not anxious to share. When they grasped that the intention was to build up bigger stores, their attitude modified perceptibly, and they prepared to make the best of it. I decided I'd have to stay on a day or two just to get the party set up. I guessed Gisella would be feeling much the same about her lot. Ingenious man, Coker. The trick is called holding the baby. But after that, I'd dodge out and join her. During the next couple of days, we worked systematically, tackling the bigger stores nearby, mostly chain stores and not very big at that. Nearly everywhere there had been others before us. The fronts of the shops were in a bad way. The windows were broken in, the floors were littered with half-open cans and spilt packages which had disappointed the finders, and now lay in a sticky, stinking mass among the fragments of window glass. But as a rule, the loss was small and the damage superficial, and we'd find the larger cases in and behind the shop untouched. It was far from easy for blind men to carry and manoeuvre heavy cases out of the place and load them onto handcarts. Then there was the job of getting them back to the billet and stowing them. But practice began to give them a knack with it. The most hampering factor was the necessity for my presence. Little or nothing could go on unless I was there to direct. It was impossible to use more than one working party at a time, though we could have made up a dozen. Nor could much go on back at the hotel while I was out with foraging squads. Moreover, such time as I had to spend investigating and prospecting the district was pretty much wasted for everyone else. Two sighted men could have got through a lot more than twice the work. Once we had started, I was too busy during the day to spend much thought beyond the actual work in hand, and too tired at night to do anything but sleep the moment I lay down. Now and again I'd say to myself, "By tomorrow night I'll have them pretty well fixed up, enough to keep them going for a bit anyway. Then I'll light out of this and find Josella." That sounded all right, but every day it was tomorrow that I'd be able to do it, and each day it became more difficult. Some of them had begun to learn a bit, but still practically nothing from foraging to can opening could go on without my being around. It seemed, the way things were going, that I became less instead of more dispensable. None of it was their fault. That was what made it difficult. Some of them were trying so damned hard. I just had to watch them, making it more and more impossible for me to play the skunk and walk out on them. A dozen times a day I cursed the man Coker for contriving me into the situation. But that didn't help to solve it. It just left me wondering how it could end. I had my first inkling of that, though I scarcely recognized it as such, on the fourth morning, or maybe it was the fifth, just as we were setting out. A woman called down the stairs that there were two sick up there. Pretty bad, she thought. My two watchdogs did not like it. "Listen," I told them, "I've had about enough of this chain gang stuff. We'd be doing a lot better than we are now without it anyway." "And have you slinking off to join your old mob?" said someone. "I'd not fool yourself," I said. "I could have slugged this pair of amateur guerrillas any hour of the day or night. I've not done it because I've got nothing against them other than their being a pair of dim-witted nuisances." "Here," one of my attachments began to expostulate. "But," I went on, "if they don't let me see what's wrong with these people, they can begin expecting to be slugged any minute from now." The two saw reason, but when we reached the room, they took good care to stand as far back as the chain allowed. The casualties turned out to be two men, one young, one middle-aged. Both had high temperatures and complained of agonized pain in the bowels. I didn't know much about such things then, but I did not need to know much to feel worried. I could think of nothing but to direct that they should be carried to an empty house nearby, and to tell one of the women to look after them as best she could. That was the beginning of a day of setbacks. The next, of a very different kind, happened around noon. We had cleared most of the food shops close to us, and I had decided to extend our range a little. From my recollections of the neighbourhood, I reckoned we ought to find another shopping street above half a mile to the north. So I led my party that way. We found the shop there all right, but something else, too. As we turned the corner and came into view of them, I stopped. In front of a chain store grocery, a party of men were trundling out cases and loading them onto a lorry. Save for the differences in the vehicle, I might have been watching my own party at work. I halted my group of 20 or so, wondering what line we should take. My inclination was to withdraw and avoid possible trouble by finding a clear field elsewhere. There was no sense in coming into conflict when there was plenty scattered in various stores for those who were organized enough to take it. But it did not fall to me to make the decision. Even while I hesitated, a red-headed young man strode confidently out of the shop door. There was no doubt that he was able to see, or, a moment later, that he had seen us. He did not share my indecisions. He reached swiftly for his pocket. The next moment a bullet hit the wall beside me with a smack. There was a brief tableau. his men and mine turning their sightless eyes towards one another in an effort to understand what was going on. Then he fired again. I supposed he had aimed at me, but the bullet found the man on my left. He gave a grunt as though he was surprised, and folded up with a kind of sigh. I dodged back round the corner, dragging the other watchdog with me.
"Quick," I said, "give me the key to these cuffs. I can't do a thing like this."
He didn't do anything except give a knowing grin. He was a one-idea man.
"Huh,"
he said. "Come off it, you don't fool me."
"Oh, for God's sake, you damned clown,"
I said, pulling on the chain to drag the body of watchdog number one nearer so that we could get better cover. The goon started to argue. Heaven knows what subtleties his dim wits were crediting me with. There was enough slack on the chain now for me to raise my arms. I did, and hammered both fists at his head so that it went back against the wall with a crack. That disposed of his argument. I found the key in his side pocket. "Listen," I told the rest. "Turn round, all of you, and keep going straight ahead. Don't separate, or you'll have had it. Get moving now." I got one wristlet open, ridded myself of the chain, and scrambled over the wall into somebody's garden. I crouched there while I got rid of the other cuff. Then I moved across to peer cautiously over the far angle of the wall. The young man with the pistol had not come rushing after us, as I had half expected. He was still with his party, giving them an instruction. And now I came to think of it. Why should he hurry? Since we had not fired back at him, he could reckon we were unarmed, and we wouldn't be able to get away fast. When he'd finished his directions, he walked out confidently into the road to a point where he had a view of my retreating group, and then began to follow them. At the corner, he stopped to look at the two prone watchdogs. Probably the chain suggested to him that one of them had been the eyes of our gang, for he put the pistol back in his pocket and began to follow the rest in a leisurely fashion. That wasn't what I had expected, and it took me a minute to see his scheme. Then it came to me that his most profitable course would be to follow them to our headquarters and see what pickings he could hijack there. He was, I had to admit, either much quicker than I at spotting chances, or he had previously given more thought to the possibilities that might arise than I had. I was glad that I had told my lot to keep straight on. Most likely they'd get tired of it after a bit, but I reckoned they'd none of them be able to find the way back to the hotel and so lead him to it. As long as they kept together, I'd be able to collect them all later on without much difficulty. The immediate question was what to do about a man who carried a pistol and didn't mind using it. In some parts of the world, one might go into the first house in sight and pick up a convenient firearm. Hampstead was not like that. It was a highly respectable suburb, unfortunately. There might possibly be a sporting gun to be found somewhere, but I would have to hunt for it. The only thing I could think of was to keep him in sight and hope that some opportunity would offer a chance to deal with him. I broke a branch off a tree, scrambled back over the wall, and began to tap my way along the curb, looking, I hoped, indistinguishable from the hundreds of blind men one had seen wandering the streets in the same way. The road ran straight for some distance. The red-headed young man was perhaps 50 yards ahead of me, and my party another 50 ahead of him. We continued like that for something over half a mile. To my relief, none of the front party showed any tendency to turn into the road which led to our base. I was beginning to wonder how long it would be before they decided that they had gone far enough, when an unexpected diversion occurred. One man, who had been lagging behind the rest, finally stopped. He dropped his stick and doubled up with his arms over his belly. Then he sank to the ground and lay there, rolling with pain. The others did not stop for him. They must have heard his moans, but probably they had no idea he was one of themselves. The young man looked towards him and hesitated. He altered his course and bore across towards the contorted figure. He stopped a few feet away from him and stood gazing down. For perhaps a quarter of a minute he regarded him carefully. Then slowly, but quite deliberately, he pulled his pistol out of his pocket and shot him through the head. The party ahead stopped at the sound of the shot. So did I. The young man made no attempt to catch up with them. In fact, he seemed suddenly to lose interest in them altogether. He turned round and came walking back down the middle of the road. I remembered to play my part and began to tap my way forward again. He paid no attention as he passed, but I was able to see his face. It was worried, and there was a grim set to his jaw. I kept going as I was until he was a decent distance behind me, then I hurried on to the rest. Brought up short by the sound of the shot, they were arguing whether to go on further or not. I broke that off by telling them that now I was no longer encumbered with my two IQ-minus watchdogs, we would be ordering things differently. I was going to get a lorry, and I would be back in 10 minutes or so to run them back to the billet in it. The finding of another organized party at work produced a new anxiety, but we found the place intact. The only news they had for me was that two more men and a woman had been taken with severe belly pains and removed to the other house. We made what preparations we could for defense against any marauders arriving while I was away. Then I picked a new party, and we set off in the lorry, this time in a different direction. I recalled that in former days when I had come up to Hampstead Heath, it had often been by way of a bus terminus where a number of small shops and stores clustered. With the aid of the street plan, I found the place again easily enough. Not only found it, but discovered it to be marvellously intact. Save for 3 or 4 broken windows, the area looked simply as if it had been closed up for a weekend. But there were differences. For one thing, no such silence had ever before hung over the locality, weekday or Sunday. And there were several bodies lying in the street. By this time one was becoming accustomed enough to that to pay them little attention. I had, in fact, wondered that there were not more to be seen, and had come to the conclusion that most people sought some kind of shelter either out of fear, or later when they became weak. It was one of the reasons that one felt a disinclination to enter any dwelling house. I stopped the lorry in front of a provision store and listened for a few seconds. The silence came down on us like a blanket. There was no sound of tapping sticks, not a wanderer in sight. Nothing moved.
"Okay," I said. "Pile out, chaps."
The locked door of the shop gave way easily. Inside there was a neat, unspoiled array of tubs of butter, cheeses, sides of bacon, cases of sugar and all the rest of it. I got the others busy. They had developed tricks of working by now and were more sure of their handling. I was able to leave them to get on with it for a bit while I examined the back storeroom and then the cellar. It was while I was below, investigating the nature of the cases down there, that I heard a sound of shouts somewhere outside. Close upon it came a thunder of trampling boots on the floor above me. One man came down through the trap door and pitched on his head. He did not move or make another sound. I jumped to it that there must be a battle with a rival gang in progress up there. I stepped across the fallen man and climbed the ladder-like stair cautiously, holding up one arm to protect my head. The first view was of numerous scuffling boots unpleasantly close and backing towards the trap. I nipped up quickly and got clear before they were on me. I was up just in time to see the plate glass window in the front give way. 3 men from outside fell in with it. A long green lash whipped after them, striking one as he lay. The other 2 scrambled among the wreckage of the display and came stumbling further into the shop. They pressed back against the rest, and 2 more men fell through the open trap door. It did not need more than a glimpse of that lash to tell what had happened. During the work of the past few days, I had all but forgotten the Triffids. By standing on a box, I could see over the heads of the men. There were 3 Triffids in my field of view, 1 out in the road, and 2 closer on the pavement. 4 men lay on the ground out there, not moving. I understood then why these shops had been untouched, and why there had been no one to be seen in the neighbourhood of the heath. At the same time, I cursed myself for not having looked at the bodies in the road more closely. 1 glimpse of a sting mark would have been enough warning.
"Hold it!" I shouted. "Stay where you are!"
I jumped down from the box, pushed away the men who were standing on the folded back lid of the trap, and got it closed.
"There's a door back here," I told them. "Take it easy now."
The first 2 took it easy. Then a Triffid sent its sting whistling into the room through the broken window. 1 man gave a scream as he fell. The rest came on in panic and swept me before them. There was a jam in the doorway. Behind us, stings swished twice again before we were clear. In the back room, I looked round panting. There were 7 of us there.
"Hold it," I said again. "We're all right in here."
I went back to the door. The rear part of the shop was out of the Triffids' range, as long as they stayed outside. I was able to reach the trapdoor in safety and raise it. The two men who had fallen down there since I left re-emerged. One nursed a broken arm, the other was merely bruised and cursing. Behind the back room lay a small yard, and across that a door in an 8-foot brick wall. I had grown cautious. Instead of going straight to the door, I climbed on the roof of an outhouse to prospect. The door, I could see, gave into a narrow alley running the full length of the block. It was empty. But beyond the wall on the far side, which seemed to terminate the gardens of a row of private houses, I could make out the tops of two Triffids motionless among the bushes. There might well be more. The wall on that side was lower, and their height would enable them to strike right across the alley with their stings. I explained to the others.
"Bloody unnatural brutes," said one. "I always did hate them bastards."
I investigated further. The building next but one to the north side turned out to be a car hire service with three of its cars on the premises. It was an awkward job getting the party over the two intervening walls, particularly the man with the broken arm, but we managed it. Somehow, too, I got them all packed into a large Daimler. When we were all set, I opened the outer doors of the place and ran back to the car. The Triffids weren't slow to be interested. That uncanny sensitiveness to sounds told them something was happening. As we drove out, a couple of them were already lurching towards the entrance. Their stings whipped out at us and slapped harmlessly against the closed windows. I swung hard round, bumping one and toppling it over. Then we were away up the road, making for a healthier neighborhood. The evening that followed was the worst I had spent since the calamity occurred. Freed of the two watchdogs, I took over a small room where I could be alone. I put 6 lighted candles in a row on the mantel shelf, and sat a long while in an armchair trying to think things out. We had come back to find that one of the men who had been taken sick the night before was dead. The other was obviously dying, and there were 4 new cases. By the time our evening meal was over, there were 2 more still. What the complaint was, I had no idea. With the lack of service and the way things were going in general, it might have been a number of things. I thought of typhoid, but I'd a hazy idea that the incubation period ruled that out. Not that it would have made much difference if I had known. All I did know about it was that it was something nasty enough to make that red-haired young man use his pistol and change his mind about following my party. It began to look to me as if I had been doing my group a questionable service from the first. I had succeeded in keeping them alive, placed between a rival gang on one side and Triffids encroaching from the heath on the other. Now there was this sickness, too. And when all was said and done, I had achieved only the postponement of starvation for a little while. As things were now, I did not see my way. And then there was Josella on my mind. The same sort of things, maybe worse, were as likely to be happening in her district. I found myself thinking of Michael Beadley and his lot again. I had known then that they were logical. Now I began to think that perhaps they had a truer humanity, too. They had seen that it was hopeless to try to save any but a very few. To give an empty hope to the rest was little better than cruelty. Besides, there were ourselves. If there were purpose in anything at all, what had we been preserved for? Not simply to waste ourselves on a forlorn task, surely. I decided that tomorrow I would go in search of Josella, and we would settle it together. The latch of the door moved with a click. The door itself opened slowly. "Who's that?" I said.
"Oh, it is you," said a girl's voice.
She came in, closing the door behind her. "What do you want?" I asked. She was tall and slim. Under 20, I guessed. Her hair waved slightly, chestnut-coloured it was. She was quiet, but one had to notice her. It was the texture of her, as well as the line. She had placed my position by my movement and voice. Her gold-brown eyes were looking just over my left shoulder. Otherwise, I'd have been sure she was studying me. She did not answer at once. It was an uncertainty which did not seem to suit the rest of her. I went on waiting for her to speak. A lump got into my throat somehow. You see, she was young, and she was beautiful. There should have been all life, maybe a wonderful life, before her. And isn't there something a little sad about youth and beauty in any circumstances? "You're going to go away from here," she said. It was half question, half statement, in a quiet voice, a little unsteadily. "I've never said that," I countered.
"No," she admitted. "But that's what the others are saying. And they're right, aren't they?"
I did not say anything to that. She went on.
"You can't. You can't leave them like this. They need you."
"I'm doing no good here," I told her. "All the hopes are false."
"But suppose they turned out not to be false?"
"They can't. Not now. We'd have known by this time."
"But if they did, after all, and you had simply walked out."
"Do you think I haven't thought of that? I'm not doing any good, I tell you. I've been like the drugs they inject to keep the patient going a little longer, no curative value, just putting it off."
She did not reply for some seconds. Then she said, unsteadily, "Life is very precious, even like this."
Her control almost cracked. I could not say anything. She recovered herself.
"You can keep us going. There's always a chance, just a chance, that something may happen, even now."
I had already said what I thought about that. I did not repeat it.
"It's so difficult," she said, as though to herself. "If I could only see you, but then, of course, if I could... Are you young? You sound young."
"I'm under 30, I told her, "and very ordinary."
"I'm 18. It was my birthday, the day the comet came."
I could not think of anything to say to that that would not seem cruel. The pause drew out. I saw that she was clenching her hands together. Then she dropped them to her sides, the knuckles quite white. She made as if to speak, but did not.
"What is it?" I asked. "What can I do except prolong this a little?"
She bit her lip, then...
They said perhaps you were lonely," she said. "I thought perhaps if..."
Her voice faltered and her knuckles went a little whiter still.
"Perhaps if you had somebody, I mean, somebody here, you might not want to leave us. Perhaps you'd stay with us."
"Oh, God," I said softly. I looked at her, standing quite straight, her lips trembling slightly. There should have been suitors clamouring for her lightest smile. She should have been happy and uncaring for a while. Then happy in caring. Life should have been enchanting to her, and love very sweet.
"You'd be kind to me, wouldn't you?" she said. "You see, I haven't..."
"Stop it! Stop it!" I told her. "You mustn't say these things to me. Please go away now." But she did not go. She stood staring at me from eyes that could not see me. "Go away!" I repeated. I could not stand the reproach of her. She was not simply herself. She was thousands upon thousands of young lives destroyed. She came closer.
"What? I believe you're crying," she said.
"Go away! For God's sake, go away!" I told her. She hesitated. Then she turned and felt her way back to the door. As she went out, "You can tell them I'll be staying. I said. The first thing I was aware of the next morning was the smell. There had been whiffs of it here and there before, but luckily the weather had been cool. Now I found that I had slept late into what was already a warmer day. I'm not going into details about the smell. Those who knew it will never forget it, for the rest of it is indescribable. It rose from every city and town for weeks, and travelled on every wind that blew. When I woke to it that morning, it convinced me beyond doubt that the end had come. Death is just the shocking end of animation. It is dissolution that is final. I lay for some minutes thinking. The only thing to do now would be to load my party into lorries and take them in relays into the country. And all the supplies we had collected? They would have to be loaded and taken too, and I, the only one able to drive, it would take days, if we had days. Upon that, I wondered what was happening in the building now. The place was oddly quiet. When I listened, I could hear a voice groaning in another room. Beyond that, nothing. I got out of bed and hurried into my clothes with a feeling of alarm. Out on the landing, I listened again. There was no sound of feet about the house. I had a sudden nasty feeling as if history were repeating itself and I were back in the hospital again. "Hey! Anybody here?" I called. Several voices answered. I opened a nearby door. There was a man in there. He looked very bad, and he was delirious. There was nothing I could do. I closed the door again. My footsteps sounded loud on the wooden stairs. On the next floor, a woman's voice called, "Bill! Bill!" She was in bed in a small room there, the girl who had come to see me the night before. She turned her head as I came in. I saw that she had it too.
"Don't come near," she said. "It is you, Bill."
"Yes."
"I thought it must be. You can still walk. They have to creep." "I'm glad, Bill. I told them you'd not go like that, but they said you had. Now they've all gone. All of them that could."
"I was asleep," I said. "What happened?"
"More and more of us like this. They were frightened."
I said helplessly,
"What can I do for you? Is there anything I can get you?"
Her face contorted. She clutched her arms round her and writhed. The spasm passed and left her with sweat trickling down her forehead.
"Please, Bill. I'm not very brave. Could you get me something to finish it?"
"Yes," I said. "I can do that for you." I was back from the chemist's in 10 minutes. I gave her a glass of water and put the stuff in her other hand. She held it there a little. Then,
"So futile. And it might all have been so different," she said. "Goodbye, Bill. Thank you for trying."
I looked down at her lying there. There was a thing that made it still more futile. I wondered how many would have said, "Take me with you," where she had said, "Stay with us." And I never even knew her name.
Chapter 9. Evacuation. It was the memory of the red-headed young man who had fired on us that conditioned my choice of a route to Westminster. Since I was 16, my interest in weapons has decreased. But in an environment reverting to savagery, it seemed that one must be prepared to behave more or less as a savage, or possibly cease to behave at all before long. In St. James's Street, there used to be several shops which would sell you any form of lethalness from a rook rifle to an elephant gun with the greatest urbanity. I left there with a mixed feeling of support and banditry. Once more I had a useful hunting knife. There was a pistol with the precise workmanship of a scientific instrument in my pocket. On the seat beside me rested a loaded 12-bore and boxes of cartridges. I had chosen a shotgun in preference to a rifle. The bang is no less convincing, and it decapitates a Triffid with a neatness which a bullet seldom achieves. And there were Triffids to be seen, right in London, now. They still appeared to avoid the streets when they could, but I had noticed several lumbering across Hyde Park, and there were others in Green Park. Very likely they were ornamental, safely docked specimens. On the other hand, maybe they weren't. And so I came to Westminster. The deadness, the finish of it all, was italicized there. The usual scatter of abandoned vehicles lay about the streets. Very few people were in sight. I saw only three who were moving. Two were tapping their way down the gutters of Whitehall, the third was in Parliament Square. He was sitting close to Lincoln's statue and clutching to him his dearest possession, a side of bacon, from which he was hacking a ragged slice with a blunt knife. Above it all rose the Houses of Parliament, with the hands of the clock stopped at 6:03. It was difficult to believe that all that meant nothing any more, that now it was just a pretentious confection in uncertain stone which could decay in peace. Let it shower its crumbling pinnacles onto the terrace as it would, there would be no more indignant members complaining of the risk to their valuable lives. Into those halls which had in their days set world echoes to good intentions and sad expediencies, the roofs could in due course fall. There would be none to stop them, and none to care. Alongside, the Thames flowed imperturbably on. So it would flow until the day the embankments crumbled, and the water spread out, and Westminster became once more an island in a marsh. Marvellously clear fretted in the unsmoked air, the abbey rose, silver-grey. It stood detached by the serenity of age from the ephemeral growths around it. It was solid on a foundation of centuries, destined perhaps for centuries yet to preserve within it the monuments to those whose work was now all destroyed. I did not loiter there. In years to come I expect some will go to look at the old abbey with romantic melancholy. But romance of that kind is an alloy of tragedy with retrospect. I was too close. Moreover, I was beginning to experience something new, the fear of being alone. I had not been alone since I walked from the hospital along Piccadilly, and then there had been bewildering novelty in all I saw. Now, for the first time, I began to feel the horror that real loneliness holds for a species that is by nature gregarious. I felt naked, exposed to all the fears that prowled. I made myself drive up on Victoria Street. The sound of the car itself alarmed me with its echoes. My impulse was to leave it and sneak silently on foot, seeking safety and cunning like a beast in the jungle. It needed all my willpower to keep myself steady and hold to my plan, for I knew what I should have done had I chanced to be allocated to this district. I should have sought supplies in its biggest department store. Somebody had stripped the provision department of the Army and Navy stores all right, but there was no one there now. I came out by a side door. A cat on the pavement was engaged in sniffing at something which might have been a bundle of rags, but was not. I clapped my hands at it. It glared at me, then slunk off. A man came round a corner. He had a gloating expression on his face, and was perseveringly rolling a large cheese along the middle of the road. When he heard my step, he halted his cheese and sat on it, brandishing his stick fiercely. I went back to my car in the main street. The probability was that Josella, too, would have chosen a hotel as a convenient headquarters. I remembered that there were several around Victoria Station, so I drove on there. It turned out that there were vastly more of them than I had thought. After I had looked into a score or more without finding any evidence of organized squatting, it began to seem pretty hopeless. I looked for someone to ask. There seemed a chance that anyone still alive here might owe it to her. I had seen only half a dozen capable of moving since I arrived in the district. Now there seemed to be none. But at last, near the corner of Buckingham Palace Road, I came across an old woman sitting huddled on a doorstep. She was tearing at a tin with broken fingernails, and alternately cursing and whimpering over it. I went to a small shop nearby and found half a dozen tins of beans overlooked on a high shelf. I discovered a tin opener, too, and went back to her. She was still futilely scrabbling away at her tin. "You'd better throw that away. It's coffee," I told her. I put the opener into her hand and gave her a tin of beans. "Listen to me," I said. "Do you know anything of a girl round here, a girl that can see? She'd be in charge of a party, most likely." I was not very hopeful, but something must have helped the old woman to keep going longer than most. It seemed almost too good to be true when she nodded. "Yes," she said as she started the opener. "You do? Where is she?" I demanded. Somehow it never occurred to me that it could be anyone but Gisella. But she shook her head.
"I don't know. I was with her lot for a bit, but I lost them. An old woman like me can't keep up with the young ones, so I lost them. They'd not wait for a poor old woman, and I could never find them again."
She went on cutting intently round the tin. "Where is she living?" I asked.
"We was all in a hotel. Don't know where it is, or I'd have found them again."
"Don't you know the name of the hotel?"
"Not me. 'Tain't no good knowing the names of places when you can't see to read them. Nor nobody else can't neither."
"But you must remember something about it."
"No, I don't."
She lifted the can and sniffed cautiously at the contents. "Look here," I said coldly. "You want to keep those tins, don't you?" She made a movement with one arm to gather them all to her. "Well, then you better tell me all you can about that hotel," I went on. "You must know, for instance, whether it was large or small." She considered, one arm still protectively about the tins.
"Downstairs it sounded sort of hollow, like it might be biggish. Likely it was smart, too, but what I mean, it had them quiet carpets and good beds and good sheets."
"Nothing else about it?"
"No, not as I... Yes, there was, though. It had two small steps outside, and you went in through one of them round and round doors."
"That's better," I said. "You're quite sure of that? If I can't find it, I can find you again, you know."
"It's God's truth, mister, two small steps and round and round door."
She rummaged in a battered bag beside her, brought out a dirty spoon, and began to taste the beans as if they were one of the jams of paradise. There were, I found, still more hotels round there than I had thought, and a surprising number of them had round and round doors. But I kept on. There was no mistaking it when I did find it. The traces and the smell were all too familiar. "Anybody here?" I called in the echoing lounge. I was about to go further in when a groan came from one corner. Over in a semi-dark recess, a man was lying on a settee. Even in the dimness, it was possible to see that he was far gone. I did not go too close. His eyes opened. For a moment, I thought that he could see.
"You there?"
he said.
"Yes, I want to..."
"Walter,"
he said.
"Christ's sake, give me some water."
I went across to the dining room and found the service room beyond. The taps were dry. I squirted a couple of siphons into a big jug and took it back with a cup. I put them down where he could reach them.
"Thanks, mate,"
he said.
"I can manage. You keep clear of me."
He dipped the cup into the jug and then drained it.
"Good,"
he said.
"Did I need that?"
And he repeated the action.
"What you doing, mate? Tain't healthy round here, no?"
"I'm looking for a girl who can see. Her name's Gisella. Is she here?"
"She was here, but you're too late, chum."
A sudden suspicion struck me like a physical stab. "You don't mean..."
"No, he's off, mate. She ain't got what I got. No, she's just gone. Same as all the rest what could."
"Where did she go, do you know?"
"Can't tell you that, mate."
"I see," I said heavily.
"You'd best be going too, chum. Hang around here long and you'll be staying for keeps like me."
He was right. I stood looking down at him. "Anything else I can get you?"
"No, this'll last me. I reckon it won't be much longer I'll need anything."
He paused. Then he added,
"Bye, mate. Thanks a lot. And if you do find her, look after her proper. She's a good girl."
While I was making a meal of tinned ham and bottled beer a little later, it occurred to me that I had not asked the man when Josella had left, but I decided that in his state he would be unlikely to have any clear idea of time. The one place I could think of to go to was the university building. I reckoned Josella would think the same, and there was a hope that some others of our dispersed party might have drifted back there in an effort to reunite. It was not a very strong hope, for common sense should have caused them to leave the town days ago. Two flags still hung above the tower, limp in the warm air of the early evening. Of the 24 or so lorries that had been accumulated in the forecourt, 4 still stood there, apparently untouched. I parked the car beside them and went into the building. My footsteps clattered in the silence.
"Hello? Hello there?"
I called.
"Is there anyone here?"
My voice echoed away down corridors and up wells, diminishing to the parody of a whisper, and then to silence. I went to the doors of the other wing and called again. Once more the echoes died away unbroken, settling softly as dust. Only then as I turned back did I notice that an inscription had been chalked on the wall inside the outer door. In large letters it gave simply an address. Tynesham Manor, Tynesham, near Devizes, Wilts. That was something, at least. I looked at it and thought. In another hour or less it would be dusk. Devizes, I guessed, at 100 miles distant, probably more. I went outside again and examined the lorries. One of them was the last that I had driven in, the one in which I had stowed my despised anti-Triffid gear. I recalled that the rest of its load was a useful assortment of food and supplies. It would be much better to arrive with that than empty-handed in a car. Nevertheless, if there were no urgent reason for it, I did not fancy driving anything, much less a large, heavily loaded lorry, by night along roads which might reasonably be expected to produce a number of hazards. If I were to pile it up, and the odds were that I should, I would lose a lot more time in finding another and transferring the load than I would by spending the night here. An early start in the morning offered much better prospects. I moved my boxes of cartridges from the car to the cab of the lorry in readiness. The gun I kept with me. I found the room from which I had rushed to the fake fire alarm exactly as I had left it. My clothes on a chair, even the cigarette case and lighter where I had placed them beside my improvised bed. It was still too early to think of sleep. I lit a cigarette, put the case in my pocket, and decided to go out. Before I went into the Russell Square Garden, I looked it over carefully. I had already begun to be suspicious of open spaces. Sure enough, I spotted one Triffid. It was in the northwest corner, standing perfectly still, but considerably taller than the bushes that surrounded it. I went closer and blew the top of it to bits with a single shot. The noise in the silent square could scarcely have been more alarming if I had let off a howitzer. When I was sure that there were no others lurking, I went into the garden and sat with my back against a tree. I stayed there perhaps 20 minutes. The sun was low, and half the square was thrown into shadow. Soon I would have to go in. While there was light, I could sustain myself. In the dark, things could steal quietly upon me. Already I was on my way back to the primitive. Before long, perhaps, I should be spending the hours of darkness in fear, as my remote ancestors must have done, watching ever distrustfully the night outside their cave. I delayed to take one more look around the square, as if it were a page of history I would learn before it was turned. And as I stood there, I heard the gritting of footsteps on the road, a slight sound, but as loud in the silence as a grinding millstone. I turned with my gun ready. Crusoe was no more startled at the sight of a footprint than I at the sound of a footfall, for it had not the hesitancy of a blind man's. I caught a glimpse in the dim light of the moving fire. As it left the road and entered the garden, I saw that it was a man. Evidently he had seen me before I heard him, for he was coming straight towards me.
"You don't need to shoot,"
he said, holding empty hands wide apart. I did not know him until he came within a few yards. Simultaneously, he recognized me. "Oh, it's you, is it?" he said. I kept the gun raised. "Hello, Coker. What are you after? Wanting me to go on another of your little parties?" I asked him. "No. You can put the thing down. Makes too much noise, anyway. That's how I found you." "No," he repeated. "I've had enough. I'm getting the hell out of here." "So am I," I said, and lowered the gun. "What happened to your bunch?" he asked. I told him. He nodded. "Same with mine. Same with the rest, I expect. Still, we tried." "The wrong way," I said. He nodded again. "Yes," he admitted. "I reckon your lot did have the right idea from the start. Only it didn't look right. And it didn't sound right a week ago." "6 days ago," I corrected him. "A week," said he. "No, I'm sure..." "Oh, well, what the hell's it matter anyway?" I said. "In the circumstances," I went on, "what do you say to declaring an amnesty and starting over again?" He agreed. "I've got it wrong," he repeated. "I thought I was the one who was taking it seriously, but I wasn't taking it seriously enough. I couldn't believe that it would last, or that some kind of help wouldn't show up. But now look at it. And it must be like this everywhere. Europe, Asia, America. Think of America smitten like this. But they must be. If they weren't, they'd have been over here, helping out and getting the place straight. That's the way it'd take them. No, I reckon your lot understood it better from the start." We ruminated for some moments, then I asked, "This disease, plague, what do you reckon it is?" "Search me, chum. I thought it must be typhoid, but someone said typhoid takes longer to develop, so I'd not know. I don't know why I've not caught it myself, except that I've been able to keep away from those that have, and to see that what I was eating was clean. I've been keeping to tins I've opened myself, and I've drunk only bottled beer. Anyway, though I've been lucky so far, I don't fancy hanging around here much longer. Where do you go now?" I told him of the address chalked on the wall. He had not yet seen it. He had been on his way to the university building when the sound of my shot had caused him to scout round with some caution. I began, and then stopped abruptly. From one of the streets west of us came the sound of a car starting. It ran up its gears quickly, and then diminished into the distance. "Well, at least there's somebody else left," said Coker. "And whoever wrote up that address. Have you any idea who that would be?" I shrugged my shoulders. It was a justifiable assumption that it was a returned member of the group that Coker had raided, or possibly some sighted person that his party had failed to catch. There was no telling how long it had been there. He thought it over. "It'll be better if there's two of us. I'll tag along with you and see what's doing, okay?" "Okay," I agreed. "I'm for turning in now, and an early start tomorrow." He was still asleep when I awoke. I dressed myself much more comfortably in the ski suit and heavy shoes than in the garments I had been wearing since his party had provided them for me. By the time I returned with a bag of assorted packets and tins, he was up and dressed too. Over breakfast we decided to improve our welcome at Tynesham by taking a loaded lorry each rather than travel together in one. "And see that the cab window closes," I suggested. "There are quite a lot of Triffid nurseries around London, particularly to the west." "Uh-huh. I've seen a few of the ugly brutes about," he said, offhandedly. "I've seen them about and in action," I told him. At the first garage we came to, we broke open a pump and filled up. Then, sounding in the silent streets like a convoy of tanks, we set off westwards with my 3-tonner in the lead. The going was wearisome. Every few dozen yards one had to weave round some derelict vehicle. Occasionally two or three together would block the road entirely so that it was necessary to go dead slow and nudge one of them out of the way. Very few of them were wrecked. The blindness seemed to have come upon the drivers swiftly, but not too suddenly for them to keep control. Usually they had been able to draw into the side of the road before they stopped. Had the catastrophe occurred by day, the main roads would have been quite impassable, and to work our way clear from the centre by side streets might have taken days, spent mostly in reversing before impenetrable thickets of vehicles and trying to find another way round. As it was, I found that our overall progress was less slow than it seemed in detail, and when, after a few miles, I noticed an overturned car beside the road, I realized that we were by this time on a route which others had followed and partially cleared ahead of us. On the further outskirts of Staines, we could begin to feel that London was behind us at last. I stopped and went back to Coker. As he switched off, the silence closed, thick and unnatural, with only the click of cooling metal to break it. I realized suddenly that I had not seen a single living creature other than a few sparrows since we had started. Coker climbed out of his cab. He stood in the middle of the road, listening and looking around him. "And yonder all before us lie deserts of vast eternity," he murmured. I looked hard at him. His grave, reflective expression turned suddenly to a grin. "Or do you prefer Shelley?" he asked. "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair." "Come on, let's find some food." "Coker," I said, as we completed the meal sitting on a store counter and spreading marmalade on biscuits. "You beat me. What are you? The first time I meet you, I find you ranting, if you will forgive the appropriate word, in a kind of dockside lingo. Now you quote Marvel to me. It doesn't make sense." He grinned. "Never did to me either," he said. "It comes of being a hybrid. You never really know what you are. My mother never really knew what I was either. At least she never could prove it. And she always held it against me that on account of that she could not get an allowance for me. It made me kind of sour about things when I was a kid. And when I left school, I used to go to meetings. More or less any kind of meetings, as long as they were protesting against something. And that led to me getting mixed up with the lot that used to come to them. I suppose they found me kind of amusing. Anyway, they used to take me along to arty political sorts of parties. After a bit, I got tired of being amusing and seeing them give a kind of double laugh, half with me and half at me, whenever I said what I thought. I reckoned I needed some of the background knowledge they had, and then I'd be able to laugh at them a bit, maybe. So I started going to evening classes, and I practiced talking the way they did for use when necessary. There's a whole lot of people don't seem to understand that you have to talk to a man in his own language before he'll take you seriously. If you talk tough and quote Shelley, they think you're cute, like a performing monkey or something. But they don't pay any attention to what you say. You have to talk the kind of lingo they're accustomed to taking seriously. And it works the other way, too. Half the political intelligentsia who talk to a working audience don't get the value of their stuff across. Not so much because they're over their audience's heads, as because most of the chaps are listening to the voice and not to the words, so they knock a big discount off what they do here because it's all a bit fancy and not like ordinary normal talk. So I reckon the thing to do was to make myself bilingual and use the right one in the right place, and occasionally the wrong one in the wrong place, unexpectedly. Surprising how that jolts them. Wonderful thing, the English caste system. Since then I've made out quite nicely in the orating business. Not what you'd call a steady job, but full of interest and variety. Wilfred Coker, meetings addressed. Subject, no object, that's me. How do you mean, subject, no object, I inquired. Well, I kind of supply the spoken word just like a printer supplies the printed word. He doesn't have to believe everything he prints. I left that for a moment. Has it happened you're not like the rest? I asked. You weren't in hospital, were you? Me? No. It just so happened that I was addressing a meeting that was protesting over police partiality in a little matter of a strike. We began about 6 o'clock, and about 5:30 the police themselves arrived to break it up. I found a handy trap door and went down into the cellar. They came down too to have a look, but they didn't find me where I'd gone to earth in a pile of shavings. They went on tramping around up above for a bit, then it was quiet. But I stayed put. I wasn't walking out into any nice little trap. It was quite comfortable there, so I went to sleep. In the morning, when I took a careful nose around, I found all this had happened. He paused thoughtfully. Well, that racket's finished. Certainly doesn't look as if there's going to be much call for my particular gifts from now on, he added. I did not dispute it. We finished our meal. He slid himself off the counter.
Come on, we'd better be shifting. Tomorrow to fresh fields and pastures new, if you'd care for a really hackneyed quotation this time.
It's more than that, it's inaccurate, I said. It's woods, not fields. He frowned and thought.
Well, bugger me, mate, so it is, he admitted.
I began to feel the lightening of spirit that Coco was already showing. The sight of the open country gave one hope of a sort. It was true that the young green crops would never be harvested when they had ripened, nor the fruit from the trees gathered, that the countryside might never again look as trim and neat as it did that day. But for all that, it would go on, after its own fashion. It was not like the towns, sterile, stopped forever. It was a place one could work and tend and still find a future. It made my existence of the previous week seem like that of a rat living on crumbs and ferreting in garbage heaps. As I looked out over the fields, I felt my spirits expanding. Places on our route, towns like Reading or Newbury, brought back the London mood for a while, but they were no more than dips in a graph of revival. There is an inability to sustain the tragic mood, a phoenix quality of the mind. It may be helpful or harmful, it is just a part of the will to survive. Yet, also, it has made it possible for us to engage in one weakening war after another. But it is a necessary part of our mechanism that we should be able to cry only for a time over even an ocean of spilt milk. The spectacular must soon become the commonplace if life is to be supportable. Under a blue sky where a few clouds sailed like celestial icebergs, the cities became a less oppressive memory, and the sense of living freshened us again like a clean wind. It does not, perhaps, excuse, but it does at least explain why from time to time I was surprised to find myself singing as I drove. At Hungerford we stopped for more food and fuel. The feeling of release continued to mount as we passed through miles of untouched country. It did not seem lonely yet, only sleeping and friendly. Even the sight of occasional little groups of triffids swaying across a field, or of others resting with their roots dug into the soil, held no hostility to spoil my mood. They were, once again, the simple objects of my suspended professional interest. Short of devices, we pulled up once more to consult the map. A little further on, we turned down a side road to the right and drove into the village of Tynesham. End of Disc 5.